relief factor, pain relief that's natural, pain relief that works, and pain relief that attacks the source of the pain. That's the experience of tens of thousands of Americans who are taking Relief Factor right now. See their incredible video endorsements at ReliefFactor.com and then order your three-week quick starter pack for just $19.95. That's less than a dollar a day. Find out if it can work for you like it works for me by ordering your three-week quick starter pack today. ReliefFactor.com, ReliefFactor.com. Be the next success story.
If you like America First, then check out our separate podcast, The Battle for 1600, with my former White House colleague, Boris Epstein. Every week, we give you the inside, in-depth analysis of what's really going on. The Battle for 1600. Subscribe today.
From the halls of
friends, to this very special edition of America First with me, your host, Sebastian Gorka, former strategist to the President of the United States, Donald J. Trump. I hope you enjoyed our first hour with Lord Conrad Black, where we did a tour de raison of the last 4 years. Please check it out if you missed it on our Rumble channel. That's rumble.com/SEBGORKA. On these special days, we get to indulge ourselves. We get to do the long dive, each guest for the whole hour, so we can go beyond the stories of the day and get to the real meat of the issue. For our second hour, we are joined by our regular guest, one of your top favorites. He is the author of a soon-to-be-released book, his latest. I don't know how he does it, how he is as prolific as he is The Dying Citizen. You can order it right now. He is, of course, the senior fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University, author of numerous books, including The Case for Trump, Professor Victor Davis Hanson. Welcome to this special edition of America First.
Thank you for having me.
So if I may abuse the chair for a moment, since we have a little bit longer with you today, we're going to talk about various of your works. We're going to talk about a comparison of the last 4 years with the national security, foreign policy environment of the last 3 months. But as a person who really am most interested in grand strategy, for me, there was a moment where the scales fell from my eyes about 20 years ago when I read John Keegan's book, The History of Warfare, at which point I understood, with a little oversimplification, if we look at matters, national security, foreign policy, and so forth, there are two large schools. There are the Clausewitzians and the anti-Clausewitzians. There are those who try and impose some rationale on warfare, on conflict, at times even to try and make it formulaic, such as Germany did, that there is a rationale, a raison d'etat, an ends, ways, and the means. And then when I read just the prologue to Keegan's book, who was deemed an iconoclast, never recognized by the British military historian establishment, he said, that's basically garbage. That is wishful thinking. That is man trying to impose reason on something which is far more to do with passion, with the irrational, the irrational, and far more to do with an expression of identity, whether it's tribal warfare thousands of years ago or in the hills of Central Asia today. Is there such a dichotomy today, Professor Hanson? And how is the West? Well, we'll get to America under Biden, under Trump. How is the West doing writ large in terms of its understanding of things strategic?
I don't think there was such a dichotomy as, I say that as someone who was a big admirer of John Keegan, who really helped me out. He wrote the foreword to one of my books, and I was in a lot of correspondence with him. But he was talking about, I think, in a large degree, the anthropological, what made people in Brazil wear war paint, or why did the Spartans have age regimentation systems, or all of these elaborate protocols that embed warfare within coming of age or military, cultural, social issues. That's true, but when it starts to manifest itself against other nation states or other tribes, and there is a science, and that science, whether it's diplomacy with balance of power or actual tactical focus of forces upon one point. So there is a science, whether it's written down or not. So I don't think they're mutually incompatible. But I think what we're at a dilemma is that Western market capitalism and constitutional government creates a degree of scientific advancement, freedom of thought, the secularization of research, so it's not impended on, let's say, religious audit or censure or saying something. You can't build that lighthouse in 16th century Constantinople because you'll rival the glory of Allah. Not that Christianity didn't do that at certain times with Galileo, but there was always a propensity in the West to allow free thought. And the result of all that is that I think today most people realize that if you're going to fight a war, you're either going to have Western arms, Western organization, or Western-like. So there's no rule that says the Chinese uniform must look Western or that North Korean jets look like our jets. So everybody has adopted that system. But within that system, there's two things to remember. One, that the more pure it is, that is, the more you allow freedom of thought and dissension and critique and back and forth, the more you refine its efficacy. And that, I think, means that the United States can eventually beat China if it has to, because it has this freedom of thought. And second, there are places where this Western paradigm does not go. It doesn't work well. It doesn't work well in the streets of Baghdad. It does not work well in the villages of Afghanistan. It does not work well in the desert expanses of tribal peoples in North Africa. It does not work well in the jungles of Vietnam. It doesn't mean that it doesn't have the power, the logistics, the organization, the ability to obliterate the enemy, but that at a sophisticated level in the 21st century, it develops a commiserate ideological restraint on it. It says that we are now so wealthy, we have iPhones, we communicate directly, we built this wonderful civilization, we're beyond war, so we're not going to blow up the people of Afghanistan, or we're not going to go in and take out a whole block of terrorists in Iraq. So we restrain ourselves, and in an asymmetrical fashion, other sides who don't restrain themselves start to find out the weakness in the Western system in those contexts. They'll say, you know what, if we put an IED here, and an army colonel with $250,000 education who's emailing his children back in Kansas every night from Basra about their homework, and he had got a beautiful suburban house and all that investment, when he's blown up by one of ours people, they take that loss as an indictment of their entire system, morally, culturally, economically, in a way that if Ahmed blew him up and he's one of 12 children that live below the poverty line, six of whom will not reach maturity because of childhood diseases, then that culture says Allah willed it, or that's just what happens, impoverished culture. So when you get these asymmetries, and we're seeing this with the Israeli war, that the people in Gaza are declaring victory even though the asymmetry of losses is astounding and materially inhuman. And so I think people in the West, they've always known that. That Alexander the Great did not do well in Afghanistan.
Right.
And so the West has, it doesn't mean that they can't fight on those terms. They have irregular forces, counterinsurgency, but it's not something that reflects our values and our strength.
In understanding that other side, one of your most enjoyable reads is the book Who Killed Homer, about the degradation of classical studies in the United States. I witnessed in my time in government a degradation of military studies in the JPME, the professional military education system, whereby we could study, there were courses on the Peloponnesian Wars or even the Balkan campaigns of the 1990s, but they were nary on Persian ways of warfare or Chinese ways of warfare or Afghan ways of warfare. Why are we still incapable of listening to what Sun Tzu wrote in The Art of War, which is know thy enemy? Where does that paucity originate from, that we really don't study the more outre strategic cultures?
I think two or three reasons. Obviously, in the 21st century, people feel that war is passe in general. And so it's like saying the oncologist loves cancer because he's studied it and knows how to deal with it. Well, the military historian then must love war. He wouldn't gravitate toward it. And therefore, he's suspect. The second is that I find this oddly more common on the left than on the right, but there's a cultural arrogance in America that people feel that their culture is so wonderful and so unstoppable that it deserves to be everywhere. And therefore, we don't really pay much attention to people. I know that people say, well, that sounds like a nationalist. It's not really. A lot of the nationalists that I know don't want to get involved and infuse their values on other people. But it's almost as if we're going to go in and teach you how to respect our values about gender or transsexuality or climate change, and we're going to save you from yourself. It's this Puritan tradition that grew up in New England that has this self-righteousness, and that means that they don't really feel that they have to read other military classics that are not Western. And the third is, and I think this is important, these military classics are sometimes heavily embedded in culture in a way that American or European or English or not. Just give you one quick example.
Let's hold that there. Yeah. We'll save it over for the next segment. We have the luxury of time. He is the author of numerous incredible works. Why the West Has Won is on my bedside stand right now, but also his future book coming out momentarily, The Dying Citizen. Check it out right now. I'm Sebastian Gorka. This is America First. Relief Factor. Have you tried every other form of pain relief only to fail and not find your answer? Well, try this incredible product that is providing liberation from pain to tens of thousands of Americans across the country, including Alicia from California. I'm a grocery store worker and have been working doubles during this coronavirus shutdown. At 52 years old, my two bad knees are not getting a rest. I literally limp to and from bed. 2 days into Relief Factor and the pain has decreased substantially. So thankful for this amazing product. That could be you. It should be you. Find out today the only way you can by ordering the 3-week quick starter pack at relieffactor.com. Call them at 800-500-8384. It'll be at your door in 3 days or less. Take it morning and evening just like I do. And I promise you, by the end of those 3 weeks, you will know whether it works for you like it works for me, Alicia, and thousands of your fellow Americans. What have you got to lose except the pain? Do it today. 800-500-8384. ReliefFactor.com. ReliefFactor.com. A special edition of America First on the Salem Radio Network with me, your host Sebastian Gorka, and our special guest Victor Davis Hanson of the Hoover Institute at Stanford University. Follow him at VD Hanson and order his new book right now, The Dying Citizen. The Dying Citizen, How Progressive Elites, Tribalism, and Globalization Are Destroying the Idea of America. Professor Hanson, that was the anthem for the United States Army. Just recently, the Army deployed, for want of a better word, a new promotional recruiting product. It was a cartoon with a little bit of film at the end. Here we have a little clip which I'd like to discuss with you. Play cuts.
I needed my own adventures, my own challenge. And after meeting with an Army recruiter, I found it. A way to prove my inner strength and maybe shatter some stereotypes along the way. I'm U.S. Army Corporal Emma Malone Lord, and I answered my calling.
Corporal Lord talks about the fact that she was raised by two lesbian quote-unquote mothers and campaigned for LGBT rights at a young age at protests. Some wit has taken the most recent Russian recruiting video and posted them side by side. The Russian recruiting video is about burly men blowing stuff up and shooting things. Let me ask, I think, the most relevant question. We're kind of horrified by the injection of intersectionality, quote-unquote, critical race theory into the military. Do these things matter in terms of threat perception from the other side? Does Moscow, does Tehran, does Pyongyang or Beijing just laugh at this, or do they see some potential serious chink in the armor on what was ostensibly the most powerful military in the world?
Well, I think they look at two things, because they have some of the same issues. They look at internal dissension, and they wonder to what degree that will weaken American battlefield efficacy. And Mao was worried about, in China himself, revolutionary fervor would cause instability. And Russia is pretty much Stalin worried about that World War II. We've been pretty immune to it as a democracy. But I think they see that the United States has been torn apart since last May, and they feel that this is the logical trajectory of where we're going. The second thing I think is more important. They look at our military budget and they say, you know, $800 billion versus our $100 billion, if it's accurate, they being the Chinese, or $80 billion or $60 billion in the case of Russia. But they also say, but we forget about the lavish retirements and the lavish overhead. They say, They are spending a lot of money that in ways that traditionally don't really lead to increased lethality on the battlefield. They're doing this gender stuff, this transgender stuff, and even more worrisome, they are going through their own ranks and trying to weed out ideologically suspect alt-right people, i.e. the January 6 types. And there, I remember, I'll give you one example. I think it was in 2009 when we had the tragedy at Fort Hood with Major Hassan Nadal killed 13 unarmed soldiers at Fort Hood. One of the first reactions of Chief of Staff George Casey was, I'm really worried that this might endanger our diversity program. And then that gave the message for the Pentagon to term it workplace violence. So they look at this and they think, you know, we had that kind of Maoist indoctrination and limitations, and we're trying to get rid of it and allow the logic of the military just to be, I don't want to use the word in reference to our army, but in their army, it's amoral. It just exists on battlefield principles. Yeah. So, yeah, I think there's a lot of overhead in the United States military that is not directly transferable to superiority in war.
You, on my Newsmax show recently, you talked about the People's Army, or the People's Armification of the U.S. Army. To that, let's listen to the man who is now Secretary of Defense, Lloyd Austin, who by writ should not have been nominated as Biden's Secretary of Defense because he had retired from the military too recently. This is what he said part of his future mission as the Secretary of Defense is.
The job of the Department of Defense is to keep America safe from our enemies. But we can't do that if some of those enemies lie within our own ranks.
Professor, you made that allusion to what was tried in communist China and the Soviet Union. They had a zampolit structure where a political officer would actually be in position right next to a unit commander to ensure the purity, the political purity of all the soldiers beneath them. Here, there is no zampolit structure in the U.S. military. It seems even worse than that. It seems at the very top, the Secretary of Defense is initiating a purge. Is this even potentially more dangerous than these politically correct propaganda recruiting videos?
Yeah, I think it is. You remember under Obama, we had the head of NASA saying that his primary mission was to be reassure the Muslim world that their contribution to science would be well recognized. That shouldn't be any of the missions of NASA. Maybe it explains why we haven't really had very successful planetary exploration under NASA. But I think it's very dangerous what he's doing, because he's injecting politics and he's saying that the military is on one side. And then this is coterminous with, we had over, I think it was 20 officers during, I think it was June 6th of 2020, when Donald Trump suggested that he might have to call in troops after they partially torched the St. John's Episcopal Church and threatened to get on the White House grounds. And all of these retired people, in pretty clearly direct violation of the Uniform Code of Military Justice for retired officers, said Donald Trump was Nazi-like. They said Donald Trump resembled Mussolini. They said he was a tyrant. Better that he leave now than later. I think it was General Hayden had pictures of Auschwitz, his border policies. And then when Hunter Biden laptop appeared, all of a sudden the Biden family drew out all of these former intelligence officers, military officers, and said, this is Russian disinformation. Well, it was American military and intelligence disinformation. And then there was the Yang, too. We recently had some conservative officers coming out and saying, you know what, if they're all going to weigh in politically about Trump, we're going to weigh in and say that the president of the United States, the commander-in-chief, is non compos mentis. So now you've created, they've sown the wind, and now we're getting the whirlwind where we're having an ideological feud of all of these retired officers. And that's not going to happen in a vacuum, because they all have liaisons and former pupils and people they've mentored in the high ranks. And people are saying, oh, my gosh, should I object to this? If I do, will the left-wing guy relieve me, or the right-wing guy come to my rescue? And we politicize the military, and that's one thing that we've never did. And I hold all of those retired generals and admirals responsible for that. Every time one of them opens their mouth and weighs in on a strictly partisan fashion to advance a political view or to virtue signal a career move that they want to be compatible with a corporate board spot or something, it's absolutely reprehensible, I think.
Clarity from the author of the upcoming book, The Dying Citizen. Order it right now. I'm Sebastian Gorka. This is America First on the Salem Radio Network. We return with Professor Hansen after these messages. Whether it's the regular Hellcat or whether it's the compensated RDP with that miniature red dot, I love them all. How did it take so long to invent a factory-compensated subcompact 9mm? Well, guess what? Springfield did it, and I'm a huge fan. And I'm Sebastian Gorka.
The Hellcat from Springfield Armory is still the smallest, highest-capacity micro-compact in the world. Available in standard or optics-ready configurations, the class-leading capacity of the Hellcat gives you 11+1 with the standard magazine and 13+1 with the included extended mag. The definitive concealed carry pistol is here. The Hellcat from Springfield Armory gives you the capacity to defend.
Segments with the good professor, and now we have six services. Where are we going to put the Space Force anthem? Is there even a Space Force anthem? I'm so sure our engineer Shad is on it right now. I'm Sebastian Gorka. If you're enjoying this show, if you'd like to support what we do here at Salem, just support our sponsors, especially Mike Lindell, the inventor of MyPillow. More than 100 incredible products at MyPillow.com. Please support him right now. 25 U.S. corporations are boycotting his products because he's a truth teller, because he's a conservative. You can get up to 66% off, thanks to Mike, if you use my name as your promotion code. Call 800-829-8468. That's 800-829-8468. MyPillow.com, promo code G-O-R-K-A. We are back with Stanford University's Hoover Institution senior fellow, strategist par excellence. Anything he writes, you should read it. But most recently, the case for Trump. Let's talk about the 4 years of the Trump administration, Professor. If we ever have a fair historical reckoning with the Trump administration, especially if you look at the last 120 days of the Biden foreign policy or just the crisis at the border. What would be the fair, objective assessment of national security leadership and foreign policy leadership of the 45th commander-in-chief?
I think he's going to be remembered most for resetting the entire last quarter century approach to China. That bipartisan Council on Foreign Relations, Brookings Institution notion that the more leeway you granted China and the more exemptions for their illegal mercantile behavior, the more they were going to become wealthy and therefore they were going to become democratic or consensual. That never happened. They were emboldened and interpreted that magnanimity as weakness to be exploited. He single-handedly did that. I say single-handedly because nobody in the Republican primary until Trump formulated that idea. The second thing, I think, is he went in the Middle East and he showed you that this last 70 years have been a failure. And one of the reasons was that we allowed the Palestinians to claim in perpetuity they were refugees in the way that we don't with the Greek Cypriots or the Prussians, who East Prussians or the Volga Germans, and or the Jews that were ethnically cleansed from the Arab world after the various wars. And then they had a veto power over what 500 million people in the Arab Middle East said. And so when he said that you're not going to get aid and you're not going to tell us what's going to happen with the embassy or with the Golan Heights, etc., that was a shocking thing. And then the Abraham Accord said the Arab countries that are doing well and Israel have a lot in common in general, but in particular they have a common foe in Iran. And then he said, take Iran out of the equation as a revolutionary disruptor with Hezbollah, the Houthis, or Hamas, and you would have peace. That was a new formulation. I can see now by undoing it, we had war almost immediately. Joe Biden's legacy is he managed to take a calm Middle East and give us a war within 120 days. So I think those two things are very important. There were other things he did that were equally important, and that is here at home in terms of security. He had an animal cunning, if I could use that word. I don't mean it in a derogatory, but he had a sense from the very beginning that the virus, the COVID virus, the SARS virus, originated in a Wuhan military lab. He didn't say it was deliberately manufactured as a weapon, but he said it was a gain of function enhancement. Everybody said that he and anybody who agreed with him was a conspiracist, and now we know over a year later, even Anthony Fauci's position is evaporating. And he was probably involved in granting funds for that type of research. And then he said, you know, every state vaccination has failed. The EU has failed. The Chinese vaccinations have failed, the Russians, comparatively. And here the United States has the Johnson, the Pfizer, and the Moderna. And it was a brilliant strategy of having some competition, giving some help to this company, a different type of help to that company, a third. And he said from the very beginning, within 10 months, we will have a vaccination.
Yeah.
In fact, he would have had a vaccination before the election, but until Pfizer mysteriously delayed the date until a few days after the election. But that was an enormously important strategic achievement, because right now we're in a better position vis-a-vis COVID than all the European countries.
I can completely concur or confirm, having worked in the White House with President Trump, there was something preternatural to his instincts. Whatever the issue was, whether it was the border, the coronavirus, the capacity to develop multiple vaccines, his instincts were truly remarkable. We're talking to the author of The Case for Trump, Professor Victor Davis Hanson of the Hoover Institution, back on America First after these messages. Welcome back, dear friends, to this very special edition of America First on the Salem Radio Network with me, your host. And in this hour, our special guest, Professor Victor Davis Hanson. I have a very, very large thank you to tell to all of you who have provided enough donations to our prison fellowship campaign to send more than 400 children to a safe Christian-centric summer camp today. Boys and girls who have lost a parent to the prison system, just like Savannah.
I'm Savannah, and I'm spending my 13th birthday at Angel Tree Camp. I've been coming here for 5 years, and my favorite part about Angel Tree Camp is going to the lake and the pool, and it makes you feel like you could be comfortable with the people around you, like you could have fun and learn about God at the same time.
If you want to make a safe summer experience possible for a child like Savannah, please make a donation in any amount today at our website, sebgorka.com, on the Angel Tree banner at the top. $200 pays for a whole week for a girl or boy, but any donation makes a difference. Let's break the cycle and let's get these children to a safe summer environment. You can call Prison Fellowship on 888-206-2794. That's 888-206-2794. Or just go to our webpage, sebgorka.com. That's S-E-B-G-O-R-K-A. And click on the Angel Tree banner at the very top. We are back with Professor Victor Davis Hanson. He is the author of The Father of Us All, War and History, Ancient and Modern. And with regards to my question for this segment, most recently, The Case for Trump. Please check out The Case for Trump. Professor Hanson, with regards to the president in the last administration, with regards to what we have seen globally, whether it is the Brexit campaign in the UK, whether it is Modi in India or other populist uprisings inside the body politic of various countries, do we have to re-examine our political taxonomy? Do words such as conservative or left and right have as much utility today as they did in the past? Or are we really talking, as some have said, of battling populisms, one a nation-state-oriented one, a Westphalian one, and the other, I don't know, a globalizing one? Is that an oversimplification?
No, I think that's what's emerging in the 21st century, in the case of the United States, but also in Europe. These great mercantile interconnected cities, London, Paris, Shanghai, Seoul, they are a very different society. I mean, the city-country was an ancient divide, but they are now more connected with each other. And when I say they, I mean the people inhabit them, the millions, the Davos crowd. So here in the United States, if I go to Stanford University and I talk to a professor, he can tell me about a good restaurant in Rome or Paris, but he's never been 150 miles to Bakersfield, right, or he's never been to Salinas. So it's a complete dichotomy now that people whose muscular labor was Xerox, I mean, in manufacturing or timber or mining, versus people who gained a $7 billion person market, that's insurance, law, academia, media, entertainment, politics. So one side loves globalization because the market just exploded, and the other side found that their skills, if they could be replicated, they were replicated elsewhere, but then we would confuse cause and effect, and we said they were replicated not because of globalization, but because these people were deplorable or losers or didn't go code or they didn't learn how to frack or whatever or they were meth heads. So we wrote off a large, so it's a cultural divide as well as economic, but yes, and that transcends these parties, and you can really see it in, you know, places like West Virginia, the old Democratic stronghold going back to the Civil War, Republican, but then it was, you know, it became it was not a slave state, but it was a solid centrist Democratic stronghold during the John Kennedy and all. And now it's, I don't know, 75% votes conservative. And you're seeing that a lot now.
Inside the Democrat Party, is it possible to ascertain the balance of power? Are the radicals, the AOC, the Bernie wing in the ascendance? Has the establishment, has the Biden, for want of a better word, the Biden, Pelosi, Schumer establishment acquiesced? Or are we going to see a tension between those two for the foreseeable future, in your estimation?
Yeah, I think it's going to be similar to what George McGovern did. He hijacked the party, and then Jimmy Carter sort of rode that. And then finally they realized that they were not going to win after 12 years, and they ran Michael Dukakis in 88, and they lost. And then they said, you know what, let's go to the new Democratic Party of Bill Clinton. Now, he was liberal, but he at least feigned the idea that he was a centrist working party. So we all talk about AOC and the Squad and Bernie and Elizabeth Warren, but if you go back to that primary, Beto, Cory Booker, Kamala Harris, none of them had anything. And the only thing that they had was, let's latch on to Joe Biden, and he can be the veneer to get us across. Or let's latch on to Mike Bloomberg. Let's latch on to somebody that doesn't terrify people, because our agenda doesn't have 50% support on any one issue. So we'll find out in the 2022 midterms, because this time I think Joe Biden will not be running on what he did in the 2020 campaign or during the transition. He will be running on a hardcore leftist, and there's going to be a referendum. And if they suffer something like 2010, that setback after the Obamacare fiasco, I think a lot of people will come forward in that party and say, you know what, you lost me my seat.
Yes.
And you're responsible. But we'll have to see. That's a very important election to stop this revolution. It's not going to work to Republicans just to pick up a seat or two. They need to really have a referendum and pick up 30, 40, 50, 60 seats and send them a message. And I think they can do that, especially with independents who are getting very worried about the direction under Biden of the country.
The only part of the equation that we haven't discussed with regards to that election is election transparency and integrity. Is the GOP, especially at the state house level, going to execute those reforms, or the return to normalcy to protect those elections, vice what we saw last year? We're talking to the author of The Dying Citizen from Stanford University's Hoover Institution. He is Professor Victor Davis Hanson. I'm Sebastian Gorka, and on the Salem Radio Network.
Portions of today's program are brought to you by Prison Fellowship.
Saluting the Coast Guards. If you ask a coastie which the oldest service in America is, they'll say it's ours. God bless you, all members of the armed services today. We are talking to Professor Victor Davis Hanson, author most recently of the upcoming book, The Dying Citizen. Order it now, How Progressive Elites, Tribalism, and Globalization Are Destroying the Idea of America. Professor Hanson, it has been commented on numerous occasions that a nation cannot have a welfare state and open borders. Right now, we have open borders, 6,000 illegal immigrants every single day. At what point will there be a moment where the Biden administration says enough, because it's been 61 days and Kamala Harris has not visited the border, hasn't given a press conference? Or are they so locked in your estimation, ideologically, into the concept of amnesty for millions of illegals, creating a new voter base for the Democrats? How long can the crisis last, in your opinion?
That's a good question. What has changed since the inauguration is that the rhetoric has changed. They used to say the border is open, we want people, they enrich America. And now they're saying things, even though they're not accurate, that the border is closed, that we have this problem, we want measured immigration, but yet it's not. And so they're saying that because somebody told them, their internal pollsters, that this is a lose-lose situation for them, and you better do something about it. Now they think they can get by with linguistic gymnastics, just lie to us and then have a Liz Cheney story or something like that to divert attention.
Yeah.
But so many people are coming across, and we're in a COVID supposedly the end of the COVID lockdown and people are not being tested. And that gets a lot of people angry that we're not even testing people who are not citizens. And with some of this lockdown money, we're giving aid to people here illegally. So I think they're just waiting to see how much opposition mounts. If it doesn't mount, then they're perfectly happy to keep the border open.
We have a few seconds left, just a few seconds. You've seen the cost of unfettered illegal immigration where you live in California. Do you think that all of these people, especially from our hemisphere, are automatically Democrat voters?
I think initially they are. They sort of mimic the Italian-American experience. So when Italians came from southern Italy and Sicily, they were far more impoverished than people from central and northern
right.
Italy. And they had more trouble. We associated with the mafia. They were traditionally Democratic voters, Catholic. They relied on more government. And then by the third generation, if your name was Cuomo or Giuliani, we couldn't really tell who you were. I think that's happening. That's happening now. That slowly, if we were to close the border and have measured legal bureaucratic immigration, the Hispanic community would start to resemble the Cuban community within 15 years.
And things could rapidly change. Any one of his books is a must read. Follow him on Twitter, VD Hansen. Thank you, Professor. Next up, my old boss, President Trump. We're going to rebroadcast my exclusive interview with the 45th Commander-in-Chief.